Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Welcome to episode 95 of Write Club the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Heather and I'm in the chair today, and I'm joined by Teresa, Steph, Linda and Pat.
Hello.
Hi.
Steph will be asking us to name the novel. Linda will be reading from her work in progress. Pat will be returning to the thorny subject of the semicolon. And Teresa will be telling us what's on her bedside table. But now we'll over to Steph.
Name the novel.
Right, are you ready? This novel, published in 1996, was the first in a series of four novels, but it was the second published work of the author, whose first book, Cause Celeb, had been published in 1994. The novel I want you to guess is the novel that was published in 1996 and was the first in a series of four.
Is this another British book?
Yeah, but you'll know it.
She says it so disparagingly.
Heather's frowning, her brows are knitting. Okay, clue two. The eponymous 30-something heroine decides to take control of her life and sets herself goals for self-improvement.
Uh-oh. Yes, I have a strong inkling.
Okay.
This epistolary novel was made into a hugely successful film starring, among others, Hugh Grant.
Could it be Bridget Jones's Diary?
It could.
By who?
Helen Fielding.
Right.
Helen Fielding.
Which was started off life as a newspaper column, I think.
Apparently.
Well, she'd done Cause Celeb, and then, of course, she had such success with Bridget Jones's Diary that she had the return of Bridget Jones, always called Bridget Jones something else. Then Bridget Jones's Baby. And all sorts, and they've all been made into films. And so it was, but I don't think when she set out, she actually set it out to be a series of four. I think she was capitalising on the commercial success. So I thought something nice and light.
You know what? I thought Bridget Jones' Diary, but I was afraid to say it because I thought it might sound silly because I didn't know it was epistolary. So.
Well, it's a diary.
Well, that isn't what epistolary means. It means written letters. But don't worry.
When I looked up epistolary, it said letters, journal entries or diaries.
Okay. Then maybe that's a broader meaning.
Yeah.
And now over to Linda, who's going to read from her work in progress.
I'm going to read a little more about Mary Magdalene. She's writing to Aunt Sugar now because Aunt Sugar, I don't know if you've met her before. I think I've mentioned her, but Aunt Sugar is the lady who pretty much raised her because while her mother was sick, her father was working, and then after her mother died. And Aunt Sugar is a sort of strange character, but she is wise, and Mary Magdalene trusts her a lot. So it's her one person that she feels she can really depend on right now. So it's from Mary Magdalene Seeger, care of Melba Mooney, 302 East Meadow Street, Union, Kentucky, June 20th, 1952. I've changed the dates, if you'll notice. Dear Aunt Sugar, how are you doing? I hope you and Chitlins are okay. I miss both of you every single day. I am okay, but Eli is not. He's in the hospital with a concussion. He saw Doc Sam sewing up Sheriff Dancy's hand where he cut it and passed out. He hit the floor like a sack of rocks and was unconscious for a good while. Doc Sam said a concussion is when the brain gets injured from getting hit or falling like he did. Most likely, it bounced against his skull and got bruised. I looked the word concussion up in the dictionary to make sure, and it said pretty much the same thing as Doc Sam. I guess he knows what he's doing. It'll take at least a week for him to be in the hospital. He'll have to rest a lot when he gets out. That'll make Melba happy. She treats him like a baby already. As you can tell, I don't like the way she acts around him. Lord knows his brain wasn't that good to begin with, and now it'll be even worse. I know you said I ought not to be so hard on him, but you know as well as I do that he is addle-brained and stubborn. Doc Sam said he would likely be back to his old self in a few weeks, but that's not saying much. Well, let me get on to something more serious. Do you believe in God? I remember I asked you once, but you didn't answer. You started talking about how birds and trees and rivers and such all seemed like a miracle. You went on so much about how wonderful nature is that you never did answer the question, and I got so sidetracked I forgot to ask again. So do you or don't you? I hope you don't, because I sure don't. I've thought about it a lot because Eli goes on with so much claptrap about God and hell and such that I can't help but have it on my mind. What he says is so contrary that it doesn't make sense. If God loves us, why would he send us to burn in hell if we don't claim him? Sounds like he's got a big ego to me. Why would Jesus dying on a cross have anything to do with saving me from sin? I don't see any connection there. I have committed a few sins that I know of, and likely some I didn't know were sins. Most of all, I break the commandment that says, honor thy father and thy mother. It's all baloney as far as I can see, at least what I hear from Eli. That's why I want to know what you think. I need to hear about it from somebody that has good sense. Aunt Sugar, please answer the question straight this time, and don't twaddle on about how beautiful the world is. Eli told me to pray for him to get well, but I'm not going to do it. I'm going to listen to Doc Sam because he's got more of a handle on it. I wish you were here. I wish I had somebody to raise me that knows how to do it right, and Eli can't cut it. I know I've got a lot of good sense, but sometimes I get tired of trying to do it all myself. Please write back soon. I love you, Mary Magdalene.
Well done.
Again, you know, humour and pathos, you know, just at the end there, you get us.
I love the way she just suddenly twists us round.
Yeah.
Poor baby.
Yeah.
I love the, I got hooked up on the idea of the dictionary.
I did too.
Serious trust issues here. Yes. Well, I love check.
Yeah, that is so in character. Now she's checked, so she's validated. He's an okay doctor. Yeah. I can rely on him.
Yeah.
I did wonder, like, where's this dictionary come from?
That's exactly what I thought. Because she's living in Melba's house. Melba's not going to have a dictionary.
So I thought my dictionary might be a nice touch because it gives the impression that she's always double-checking.
Yeah. Yeah,
what she
learning words. So put in my dictionary, that's a really good idea. Yeah. Like that.
I came up with exactly the same observation. I thought, well, he's only We've just been doing this too long. where did she get the dictionary from?
You know? Okay.
Is she carrying one?
Well, it's a lot for her to carry if she's carrying her little notebook and everything else. I just figured it was from Melba's house. But you obviously don't think Melba's that smart.
In 1952.
yeah, travelling salesmen, everybody had them.
Maybe.
Well, then we should know where it comes from.
Right. It's an Encyclopedia Britannica.
It tugs you out of the fictive dream. Yeah. So either I looked it up in Melba's dictionary or I went to the library.
I think my dictionary works because we assume she had it in the truck or whatever, you know, she could refer to.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other area which jarred a little bit for me was where she says, I hope you don't, because I sure don't believe in God. Mm-hmm. Because everything else seems to be that, she isn't sure, but she's checking with Aunt Sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you believe in it? And if she's made her mind up, I don't believe, I hope you don't believe because I sure don't, then why is it so important to her to answer the question straight this time?
Okay.
So, you know, because she's saying, well, I need to hear about it from somebody that has good sense.
Yeah.
So why is she saying, oh, well, I've made my mind up?
Well, except that it's about, you know, perhaps a lack of self-knowledge or, you know, confidently saying, I don't believe it, but can you just reassure me?
She's only 10, you know.
Yeah,
Anyway.
Having said that, I've thought about it a lot because Eli goes on with so much and what he says is so contrary. That is so her.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant. And the paragraph about him... how he fell over and bruised his head and was addle-headed already is just hysterical.
It's good.
know, he'll be back to himself in a few weeks, but that's not saying much. You know. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And just queried, following on from that, well, let me go on to something more serious. Because it kind of made it sound as if she was joking when talking about Eli.
Oh.
Or is that just me reading it?
Well, maybe I should say, let me go on to the point of this letter or something.
Do you know what I mean? It's,
yeah.
It's, okay. You know, when, yeah, oh, seriously, though. Mm. You okay. say seriously, though. It's, yeah. You've been joking and you good change point. The tone.
Okay.
And I don't think, she's not joking. That's right. How she.
She thinks he is, I don't
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. That's a good point. Thanks.
And I hadn't picked it up before, but when you read it then, it sounds like he's got a big ego. Yeah. And I just wondered whether that's a thought or a concept for even a sort of fairly, you know, advanced 10-year-old.
Well, the carries a dictionary with her.
In 1952.
Yeah, 1952. When did the ego...
Oh, that's 19th century. Freudian. Freudian. It's Freud stuff.
Would that have been commonly understood?
Well, that's what I was thinking.
I think it came into the common domain probably around the 1920s.
Oh, really?
I don't know.
Right,
that's
well, maybe I could say something else
but
there.
Same as you, like Steph, I thought that it
sounds like he's not very nice.
Mm. Okay. Sounds like he's got a big head.
Yeah, big head. Yeah, that big head was good.
But, you know, I think, you know, it's a matter of opinion. It's one of those, isn't it? Yeah. If she's a girl who carries a dictionary and likes to use sophisticated language, why wouldn't she say he's got a big ego? But you do what you think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's my notes.
And I thank you all very much for your comments.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are gaps between what I've been reading in this piece, which will be filled in later.
But I thought it was giving us the letter is a good device for showing us, for letting her speak to us directly.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, although she's kind of the main character, the focaliser of the novel, she can't speak to us directly. So the letter gives us a good insight.
Mm. Good, Okay. I remember the last time I had a letter to Aunt Sugar. It was basically recapping the things they'd done, which, as you pointed out, was really going to be quite redundant for the reader. So this is good. And I wanted to ask what you thought about her last name. I have gone from Potts to Dawes to Winslow to all sorts of last names.
Why did you choose Seeger?
Because she's a seeker. She's a seeker, and I thought it kind of reflected that kind of sound.
Without being
was that a name that you would have heard in the South of America and
I need
in
to
the
look
Southern
that
States?
Up, don't I? Seeker. I didn't want to say outright searcher or seeker, but because it's too obvious. But I don't know. Any suggestions would be helpful. But
it's worth looking at census for 18. For the 1950s.
Yeah, okay.
Where did Pete Seeger come from?
He's
New York, I think. But it was S-E-A-G-E-R. But anyway, I'll check it out and see. I just wanted her name to reflect. She and Eli, they're both searchers, seekers, but maybe for different things.
Now, we'll give it some thought.
Yes.
But it doesn't jar with me, Seeger. It's a perfectly okay name without attracting too much attention. You don't want a name that people are always thinking, oh, that's a funny name, or that's an unusual name. You just want, you know, she is who she is, Mary Magdalene, and so the surname.
I looked at a lot of synonyms, and I looked up the meanings of various names and stuff, and now I can't remember what Seeger was, but it seemed to me to be rather close to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, there's Palmer, which is Pilgrim.
Yes, I thought about Palmer, Pilgrim. And that might be a better one than Seeger, but I'll look up some Southern names and see what I find.
I think the census is a good idea.
All the deaths in 1950s in that part of America, just get the names of people that were, because, you know, then you know that those names were prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now over to Pat, who's going to tell us about a semicolon.
Well, what I'm going to tell you about is some of the background to the semicolon, not necessarily too much about how to use it. We've done that, and I'm sure you're all experts by now. But I found this article about a book the whole book about the semicolon, written by a Cecilia Watson, who is a historian and philosopher of science and a teacher of writing and the humanities. And apparently the semicolon itself was a Renaissance invention. It first appeared in 1494 in a book published in Venice, which was an essay written in dialogue form about climbing Mount Etna. Its author was Pietro Bembo, but he's best known today not for his book, but for the typeface designed by Francesco Griffo, in which the first semicolon was displayed, i.e. Bembo.
Fascinating.
It is. I thought so. And the mark was a hybrid between a comma and a colon, and its purpose was to prolong a pause or create a more distinct separation between parts of a sentence. In the old days, punctuation simply indicated a pause, but eventually grammarians and copy editors came along and made themselves indispensable by punctuating writers' prose to delineate clauses properly, such that punctuation served syntax. That is, the commas, semicolons and colons were put into the sentence in order to highlight or subordinate or otherwise conduct its elements, connecting them syntactically. One of the rules is that unless you're composing a list, a semicolon's supposed to be followed by a complete clause. The semicolon can take the place of a conjunction like and or but it shouldn't be used in addition to it. Sentence length has some effect. A long, complex sentence may benefit from a semicolon to clarify it. But if a sentence reads okay without, then it's best to leave it alone. Apparently Watson has been keeping an eye out for effective semicolons for years, and she calculated that there were 4,000 and odd semicolons in Moby Dick. But she had a special fondness for the rare semicolon in Raymond Chandler. Because, of course, Raymond Chandler's style was very sort of direct and not, he wasn't given to sort of long, convoluted sentences. But she quotes a sentence in which he describes his room. In it was everything that was mine, that had any association for me, any past, anything that took the place of a family. Full stop. Not much. Semicolon. A few books, pictures, radio, chessmen, all letters, stuff like that. In Watson's view, that choice of a semicolon after not much creates a reflective silence. Mm. The semicolon reads as Marlowe having to stop to think.
Yeah. I would have said a colon before a list.
I was thinking that.
Yeah.
But there you go.
She also comments on the topic of semicolons and the law, which just reminded me of the Oxford comma issue. And apparently this is even worse than people getting or not getting their back pay. Ambiguity can lead to trouble in the law. In a New Jersey murder trial in 1927, a sloppy punctuation caused one of the defendants to be sentenced to life in imprisonment, while the other was sentenced to death for the same crime.
Oh! How is the punctuation responsible?
Because of the way somebody read it. I don't have more details, but that's fascinating.
Well, I can see that she was fascinated by them, the fact that she's managed to write a whole book. But I have to say, my brain partly exploded just hearing you talk about it.
Me too.
She does say that the semicolon's two main detractors are Donald Barthelme, with whom I'm not familiar, and Linda's old friend, Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes, he doesn't like them.
Barthelme found
and
the semicolon.
King and Hemingway and all that.
They don't like them either.
No, they would detest them.
But Barthelme found the semicolon ugly as a tick on a dog's belly, which sounds like something that Mary Magdalene might say. But Vonnegut wrote that semicolons are transvestite hermaphrodites representing absolutely nothing. And I'd like to see him try getting away with these days.
Yes, there's nothing wrong with being a transvestite hermaphrodite.
No, absolutely not.
No, we defend everybody's right
to be so.
Well, so what's that book called?
Oh, it's called Semicolon, The Past, Present and Future of a Misunderstood Mark.
And is there a colon or a semicolon in the title?
Oh, there is a colon.
Right.
Yeah. So, please don't buy me that for Christmas.
No, me neither. Me neither. I'm not going on my Sundoku. My Sundoku is safe today.
I wonder how many sentences or how long that book is, how many pages are in that book.
It's not a very long book, it's quite short.
Well, thank goodness.
But
for
also,
that.
what can you say about someone who's counted the semicolons in Moby Dick?
I don't know. That's very curious.
Unless
isn't
there's
it?
Some clever software that can
yes,
tell
probably
you.
Yes, probably you can do it with software.
Yeah, rather than going through it.
Yeah, yeah, find.
May have yes. done a find, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But then she'd have to have the text in real text, wouldn't she? Not
no,
in the
PDF. She could just put the semicolon in find.
Yeah, but you'd have to have. The manuscript in text format
that's right.
to be able to do that.
Interesting.
Well, I shan't be pursuing that, definitely.
Well, I'm just wondering.
No, you're just Philistines.
What's nice is that Pat has given us a succinct synopsis,
yeah.
made it entertaining, and we don't have to read the book.
We can talk intelligently.
Oh, that's right.
I'm going to see if it's on Amazon.
Well, thank you very much for that, Pat. Now, Linda has found some interesting material on plot points. So, over to Linda.
I have been struggling with plot points and structure and trying to find the initiating incident and all of these things. It confuses me so much looking for where this happened and where that happened. And so I've been online a lot, checking out material. One thing I found that was helpful, I'm so sorry, I don't remember where I saw this, but it made an impression. I should have. But it was somebody was talking about a book and the breaking down the plot points, and they weren't that significant. I mean, they were important to that book, but I've always been looking for something that was really strong and big, but it could be as much as just a piece of dialogue that turned something, you know. I thought that was interesting, and it seemed to me that now I could be more certain of identifying these points. If it didn't have to be something huge, like a bomb going off.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does depend on the kind of book, doesn't it? Because
yes.
some books are not going to have high drama. That's not in the nature of them. So their turning points are going to be, you know, a decision made or a decision taken away from somebody.
Right.
You know, it can be something very small, an unexpected visitor.
Mm.
It, you know, it could be anything, but it's something that takes the narrative in a different direction
right.
at that moment.
Right. And so now I think I will search again in my work and see whether that I can find that more useful or not, because I just struggle with knowing. And I always have thought of climax as being the end, but climax in these plot points is it's in the middle.
I've got this list here of terms which might be useful to discuss, because it runs through the kind of seven areas of a story or a novel or a book, whatever you want to call it. And the first one is what we sometimes call exposition, but I call other things exposition, but it's really the opening of the story, the beginning of the story, the place where you introduce the character in the setting, which is, if you like, the contract with the reader, the promise to the reader. What would you, have you come across that word? Exposition?
Yeah. And I've got an example here from To Kill a Mockingbird, which I think a lot of listeners will be familiar with. At the opening, the story begins with the introduction of the main characters. They're not all introduced together, but over a series of chapters they're introduced. Background information on the Finch family is given. We learn that Jem's broken his arm, and the setting, Macomb County is also introduced, and that is the exposition, because once you've got that information, then the story can proceed.
You can build, yeah, build on the story
from, yeah, there.
Yeah. Well, you've placed the people in a, yeah, particular spot, so we're comfortable with, yeah, knowing
the time and
where
place
they are.
And,
yeah,
and, yeah, the reader knows who the key characters, yeah, are and where they are and so, yeah, on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, the next of these items was conflict, and that's where the protagonist, the key character, faces some sort of conflict, obstacle, problem.
Right.
It could be all sorts of things. So what would it be in To Kill a Mockingbird then? The
conflict? Well, I think that the plot is quite complex in To Kill a Mockingbird, I think. But you could say when the children find out that their father is going to be defending a black man in a rape trial, and they understand that the town is against him, and so that's certainly a moment where they understand that there's going to be a difficult time ahead of them.
Right.
But that might be the inciting incident as well.
Well, is that the same as conflict or not?
Not according to this list that I found. Conflict is what, you know, what's the character's problem. So, for example, with Grace...
Mm-hmm.
Her conflict is that she hears voices, and the inciting incident is when she gets committed to hospital.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So until she's actually committed to hospital, there's a chance she can go back to her old life.
Yeah.
So,
right.
So the conflict is that she's hearing voices, that people come and take her away. When she gets to hospital,
yeah,
she's got a week to prove that she's okay.
Right.
And for me, the inciting incident, the moment that absolutely changes from normal to a new world, changes her life, is the moment when the doctor says to her, you'll be committed indefinitely, so you're not getting out of here. To me, that's the inciting incident.
Okay.
And you could argue it's when she gets taken away. Right. You could say that's the inciting incident.
I just think for me, we've got to be careful to not try and write it exactly as any of these.
Absolutely.
It should be... You know, we shouldn't be hung up on, you know, whether it's got an inciting incident. If it's a good story and if it flows well and it makes sense, you don't even have to do the exposition at the beginning. You know, that can be halfway through. You know, quite a few novels do that.
Yes.
And we can get a bit bogged down, I think, with rules.
I'm reading John York, Into the Woods, and he talks about these patterns that exist in stories, and it's they exist before anybody ever coined the terms or whatever, and we almost do it instinctively.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think there's a difference between the cultural knowledge we've absorbed that allows us to write in a certain way without too much effort. Mm-hmm. But also it's okay to examine your work and say, has it got enough? Yeah. Has it got enough interest and turning
points? I think
what
it does is it gives us the language to discuss it, doesn't it? Because, you know, if we can say, I mean, the next on this list is rising action, which is the events that lead up to the climax. So something happens, and in some schools it says changing from the normal world, you know, if the hero's journey moves from the normal world to the abnormal world.
Right. Yeah.
And then you have rising action that leads to the climax.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it doesn't matter how long or short that rising action is. It could come very quickly after the inciting incident, and then it could rise again to another climax and so on. And a lot of books do that. You know, action-adventure books will do that. But it does mean when we're discussing it with one another, we have the language to say, you know, where's the rising action? The climax hit me out of the blue. I didn't see it coming.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is part, you know, other words we've used, like foreshadowing.
Right.
You know, and actually it's possibly useful in working out sometimes why, you know, you say the story should just flow and so on, but sometimes when it doesn't, or when you've, you know, something's been written and you think, well, you know, this doesn't work, it's identifying why it's not working.
And what's missing.
Because.
Yeah. Well, I have something else here and I'm thinking how many different names or ways of referring to these points that people have. You know, here I have this is from a site about plot pivot points and the inciting incident. I was looking at Mary Magdalene with this, and the inciting incident it describes is the moment your main character brushes up against the thing or person that will eventually change their world irrevocably. And I thought for Mary Magdalene that would be when she meets Saint Fennel for the first time. She was glamorous, sophisticated, smelled like life in a larger world, and Mary Magdalene wants what Aunt Fainall has.
Right. But is that moment actually in your novel?
Yes, it's at the funeral when her mother was being buried.
Okay.
And so that's early in the...
So that's a bit that I haven't read. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was thinking about what Stephanie said about Grace and about Ronella, because for me, the inciting incident in Ronella is her encounter with the one-eyed woman when her, mm-hmm. her sister is snatched away.
Oh.
But it's not in the first chapter. It's not in the second chapter. Mm. I think that's true of your book as well. And so, and I think that's okay. You know, there's a lot of other conflict going on within those books, within those narratives. And we are, we're getting to know the characters. We're getting to know the environment. And then something major happens. So I suppose what I'm saying is the inciting incident, some people would say get it in there right at the beginning, but I don't think it necessarily has to be.
No, but I think to be able to say this is the inciting incident in my story helps you to understand what conflict is your story is going to resolve.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody in a story goes on a journey. You know, if people just get up, go to work, have a normal day and come home again, nothing changes.
Right.
It's not really a story, it's is not, it? Nobody wants to read it anyway.
I guess so are you saying then that the first part would just be exposition and that could go on for a couple of chapters?
I wouldn't say there's a rule. I would say what works in your book.
For me, exposition happens all the way through a novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because to me, exposition is like, you know, like Mary Magdalene's letter to Aunt Sugar, which says, "Do you believe in God?" That's an exposition of one of Mary Magdalene's key problems is that her father's decided to become a preacher and she doesn't believe in God, which is another conflict in an already conflicted life.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like, it's a subplot.
Yeah.
It's a subplot within the overall story is she wants to go be like Aunt Faye now. She wants to go to this very glamorous place and they go on a journey. There are different arcs for each character. Right. And one of the subplots is that she's struggling with faith.
Right.
And her father is convinced that he's, you know, a preacher. That sets up another conflict.
Has a hotline to God.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. And that sets up another conflict in her. I personally, as I said at the beginning, you know, I don't necessarily think exposition only happens at the beginning.
No, I think that's the problem with all these schemes is you can look at them and think, I have to follow step A, B, C, D, and that can stultify your writing.
Okay.
And we all know, I mean, you know, I sometimes, you know, watch a drama on TV and I'll say, writing by numbers. It's not inspiring. Mm. It's not interesting. You know, and some books are like that as well. You just think, well, yeah, you've got a formula and you're sticking to it. Mm. And it's not that interesting.
So, well, don't you think, though, that it would help identifying these places or thinking about them?
Absolutely.
Wouldn't it help in outlining? Or
yes, it does. Yes. And that's where you get something like the three-act structure. That's another framework.
Uh-huh.
Which you can plan your story on, but it depends if you're a plotter or a pantser.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, some people plot their story before they write it, and other people let the story write itself.
Yeah. I think the point about if you're stuck, if it's flowing, if it's working, then, you know, for me, don't fix it, just carry
Absolutely
on.
Yeah.
But if you are struggling to work out how can I get from here to there, then I think that's when it's useful to maybe recheck, find a structure that would fit.
Yeah. And surely that, you know, there's, the skill of the writer is in having the elements and the way they fit them together. So, like you say, not necessarily exposition here at the beginning. Oh, chapter five now, better move on to inciting incident. Oh, need a bit of rising action here.
Yeah.
It's getting all those elements in there, but the skilled writer sort of doesn't do it by numbers, like Teresa said.
I think Teresa's point that we actually, you know, we've been listening to stories, say we as a community, we've been listening to stories for thousands of years before writing ever happened.
Yeah.
And stories said, here's a character that I want you to care about.
Mm.
Here's a problem he or she had. Here's how that problem manifested itself.
Mm.
Here's, you know, the big dramatic moment when they overcame that problem and then they all lived happily ever after and this is how they all lived. And it's that kind of arc, isn't it?
That. Who wrote The Battle Mage, the gentleman that we interviewed? Because he talked about Hercule Poirot, Robin Hood. He reckons that there were, you know, this kind of set stories.
Yes. Mm. Well, there are books that say you know, there's only ever been seven stories.
That was the kind of thing he said, and I can't remember his name, but he interviewed very well, and it came over really.
Well, speaking of how many stories there are, plot lines, I read that there were seven. Then I read that there were 36.
But it's about reinvesting those or twisting them or making them something different, however many there are. Mm-hmm. But again, as you know, John York makes this point very well. He said it's almost impossible to imagine that with only eight musical notes, we haven't run out of music.
Oh, yeah.
And the same with the 26 letters of mm-hmm. our alphabet, mm-hmm. You know, that mm-hmm. we can still create new, flexible, variable, mm. interesting, fascinating. Mm. We're creating new words all the time, never mind new books and stories. So, you know, it isn't a limitation if you say there are seven plots, you know. And, of course, you know, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy wins girl in the end, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, but that can be made, you know. It
can be made into boy meets boy.
Boy meets boy, whatever. But also, you know, there are, it's how you get from A to B. Who is the boy? Who is he, and what is his problem, and what gets in the way, and you know, so there are infinite variations on.
And one of the things I'm struggling with my current work in progress is that I've decided there are going to be a cast of characters. I've got these four, maybe five women who are all together, and so I'm giving each of them some sort of conflict or problem, because that. They all need to have something to, otherwise there's no story about them. They shouldn't be there, arguably. But how do I make the problems dovetail so that it makes a satisfying story that their conflicts are all kind of resolved in the same, all wrapped up in the same thing? Otherwise, I've got four short stories.
Or not. I mean,
The thing is, you
need a conclusion, but everybody doesn't necessarily end up getting what they want. Some people may not get what they want, but they may get what they need, or they may actually just be, you know,
but that's a
failure.
Because I've given myself a cast rather than one protagonist. Right. Because I've given myself a protagonist and three major secondary characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's what I do with them, and that's actually caused me a problem. So plotting has become, and looking for plot points has become quite critical for me in that world.
Yeah.
Whereas, frankly, with Grace, because she was only one person, I kind of knew what her overarching conflict, climax, resolution was. I knew what the story was. And then within that, with the rising action, I put other obstacles in her way. I had had people leaving the hospital and leaving her alone. I had people getting into fights in the laundry. You know, I had arguments, petty arguments and that kind of thing. That was relatively easy compared to what I'm trying to do now. Because it was one person.
Mm. Well, you know what I was just thinking? You could do what Pat does and just kill them off.
Somebody, I want to write a happy story.
Yes, I've yet to do that.
Because happy is boring. That's fine.
Well, maybe happy at the end, but not...
I don't know. I'm just thinking, I'm sure you could almost, because their shared story is the setting, in a sense, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And they could all have their own individual stories.
Yes, they have. But it's how I dovetail them, how I make those stories relevant to one another.
But do they absolutely have to be?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't know. What I'm saying is because I'm not quite sure how to resolve everybody's problem, I'm finding that plotting and looking at structure up front has become more important to me than perhaps it did before.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a danger of it becoming contrived.
Yes. So, absolutely.
That's right.
In the hands of a lesser writer.
Of course.
But that's the journey we're all on, isn't it? I mean, you talked about plotters and pantsers, and I would say... 2 years ago, I just started writing stuff, not knowing where it was going. But now I'm in the middle of this novel, and I've done some plotting as I go, and I'm learning as I go and learning.
Yeah.
And when I start again with another novel, I will be doing some plotting in advance, but also allowing for things to go off plot. That's okay too, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, but,
well, have we gone through all the plot points?
I want to ask, coming back to To Kill a Mockingbird,
What would you say is the inciting incident?
Well, this sheet I have here, I didn't find particularly helpful, but it's from helpingwritersbecomeauthors.com. Mm. And the author of this website says there are a few possible inciting events. The discovery of pennies in the tree,
mm-hmm.
Scout hearing Boo's laughter, Jem nearly getting shot by Boo's father, then finding his pants mended. So, you know, that's not particularly helpful.
No.
If you're saying what's the inciting incident, mm. well, it could be this, it could be that, it could be the other. I have to say, or I haven't read To Kill a Mockingbird in 45 years.
Mm. Really?
Yeah. I was thinking exactly the same thing because I think I read it at school.
Yeah, exactly. It was an O-level text.
Mm,
yeah.
Right. Well, now, what do you think is the... Have you got something else there?
No,
For the inciting incident.
I was trying to work out, because part of the difficulty is you've got plot and subplot, haven't you?
Mm.
So you've got these different plots going on.
Yeah.
And so...
Which is what makes a book so good, when you get these multi-layered
stories. So then does the inciting incident have to be the one that's connected to the main plot, or might it be the subplot? And I think possibly the thing with the tree and... Boo Radley and so on, could be, because that starts things going. But is that the main plot, or is the Tom Robinson story the main plot? Because even there, you can argue.
Again, this Helping Writers Become Authors post says, one of the most interesting things about the structure in this character-driven story is that the inciting event is actually a framing device for the Boo Radley subplot, which picks back up in the final eighth of the story.
Mm.
The main plot, the trial of Tom Robinson, is hinted at in the first act only thematically.
Mm.
So if we accept that, then what that's telling us is that this novel doesn't follow these given structures.
Right.
This
highly successful, one of the most successful novels of all time doesn't follow the rules.
Yeah.
But I always think knowing the rules means that it's easier to break them.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Right. And you wouldn't expect somebody to play the piano without having a few lessons first.
Right.
No.
So, I guess Teresa's take your pick, huh?
Yeah, it's interesting that this, obviously one of the most popular and respected books ever written, has been subjected to a lot of analysis by different authors or aspiring authors. Knowing all this doesn't make me able to write To Kill a Mockingbird or to write anything of that calibre or anything that's going to have that status. And maybe that's a little bit what these people are looking for. It's like, if we can analyse this book, then we can do something
as great.
There is
no magic formula. I do not believe there's a magic formula. I've bought dozens of books about plotting and storytelling and so on.
And I think, again, you know, there are some great books about writing, but there's so much out there. And so you have to listen, you know, the one, I mean, as I said, I've started this Into the Woods, which was given me as a gift. But that's a book I've heard about and heard about and heard about. And so as soon as I saw it, I thought, great, I know this is going to be good. And it is.
Mm.
You know, there are certain books that writers recommend. And I also, you know, I thought the Bang to Rights website is absolutely brilliant.
One book that I did find useful out of the dozens I've bought was actually a book that I read before I ever wanted to get serious about writing. It's actually when I was in business. And it was called The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell, and he was talking about the moment of critical mass, the threshold, and actually he says that if you know, do something for 10,000 hours, then you'll suddenly find that you're good at it. And I think that's what it is. You just keep on writing, and when you've been doing it for 10,000 hours, you'll have worked out what your plot is.
Well,
nothing like hard work and resilience.
Yes, but also learning and listening and sharing and all of those things.
Which is what we're doing here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And in a book on screenwriting, which I will check the name of the book and the author, but he talks about the three T's, which is time, talent and tenacity.
Mm-hmm.
And really, talent is a very small part of achieving anything, writing a book or a screenplay.
Tenacity.
You need to give yourself time to learn your craft, and you need to be very tenacious.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. I've just been trying to figure out, if you have to do it for 10,000 hours and you write for 5 hours a day, isn't that about 2,000 days? So how many years is 2,000 days? I won't live long enough.
Well, the thing is, you've already done your 10,000 hours.
That's the point. We were doing it when we were at school.
Writing
comprehension.
Okay. And if I could count that, I thought I had to start from
now.
Okay. Raise everything. Oh.
Great.
It's the competency ladder, isn't it? Getting to unconscious competence.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So just to kind of finish off with these seven terms, we've talked about inciting incident, rising action, climax. Climax is like, the dramatic moment, the car chase, the showdown,
right?
Whatever.
It's when the music gets loud on the film.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. And then after the climax, there's falling action, which events that lead to the solving of the story's problems. Mm. And the resolution is where the end of the story, where the loose ends are all tied up. But again, that doesn't necessarily happen right at the end. The resolution sometimes happens at the beginning, and then we go back and look at how we got to the resolution. Mm-hmm. Or the resolution is followed by a couple of, and this is what happened after that, they all went off and lived happily ever after.
Yeah.
And some books end with the resolution are a bit unsatisfactory, aren't they? Because you think, I want to know what happened. Mm, I want to know.
Yeah.
I know it's resolved, but I want to know what happened. Did they end up together? Did the boy get the girl?
Or sometimes it's quite monotonous, because it's like every loose end's got to be, sort of tied up.
I find in some books that they're so busy tying up the loose ends that you get distracted by the way that they're tying up the loose ends. Mm-hmm. And I find that annoying. Another thing that I find really annoying is if I'm reading a book or watching a movie and we come to that resolution, I'm like you, Steph, don't stop. Don't say the end. I hate when movies go black at that point. I want to live with them a little while and see how things go,
Well, there are books, which is lovely, when you don't actually know what happens at the end.
Yes.
You're like, quite often then it's you want the sequel, don't you?
Yes.
I mean, The Handmaid's Tale is a classic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Offred goes off in the van at the end of...
Mm.
I mean, for those that have watched the watched the television series, obviously it goes beyond that, but series one of the television series was fairly close to the book. And she goes off in a van at the end and we don't know what happened to her.
Oh.
Mm.
We go, is she going off to be hung, executed? Mm. Is she going to the colonies, or is she going to freedom? We just don't know. Mm. And that left itself open for a sequel.
Mm.
Well, thank you, Steph. Enough. I haven't read it yet, and now I don't have to.
Why? Because you know the end.
Yeah. No, that's not true, because I always go and read the ending of a book anyway before. I do. I can't stand the suspense.
Well, there we have it. The secret is out. How Linda reads a book. Okay, well, thank you very much for that. We're almost at the end, but first of all, Teresa is going to tell us what's on her bedside table.
Yes, at the moment I'm reading Where the Past Begins, a writer's memoir by Amy Tan. In Where the Past Begins, Amy Tan is at her most intimate in revealing the truths and inspirations that underlie her extraordinary fiction. By delving into vivid memories of her traumatic childhood, confessions of self-doubt in her journals, and heartbreaking letters to and from her mother, she gathers together evidence of all that made it both unlikely and inevitable that she would become a writer. And I'm very much enjoying this, and I will admit I haven't read any of her fiction, but I do want to now that I've got into this book. I'll just give you a little quote. The characters arrive with stiff personalities or histrionic ones. They will remain caricatures until I can truly feel them. At several points in the writing, I will realise I have embarked on an impossible task. I will have fewer than 100 pages, always fewer than 100, and they are all bad. I will be seized with paralysing existential dread that I will never finish this book. Who I was an hour ago no longer exists. This is not writer's block. This is chaos with no way out. The metaphoric connections have been cut. the wonders are gone. The worst has happened. I am no longer a writer. And then, after another 5 minutes of self-flagellation, I start writing again.
Oh, brilliant.
Good.
What did she write?
The first one was the Joy Luck Club, I think.
Yeah.
The first very popular one.
Yeah.
Right. And she's written several since then.
The Joy Luck Club, The Kitchen God's Wife, The 100 Secret Senses, The Bone Setter's Daughter, Saving Frisch from Drowning, The Valley of Amazement. That's her fiction.
Right.
Mm.
And in here, there are little bits of her fiction as well. Uh-huh. So there's a very a wonderful little story that is stuck in my mind. But it was intended as the prologue for another book.
Mm.
But on its own, as a standalone story, it's just brilliant. So a good book. I recommend it.
Sounds great.
Thank you, Teresa. Well, that was Writers Club, the podcast. Thank you, all of you, who take the time to listen. Do get in touch and let us know what you're reading and writing. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Join our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club the Podcast. Please leave a review and do tell all your friends about us. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.